Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are still in the North Carolina debates. And as I kind of look at it, because I've been trying to come close to predicting how much further we've got abuse of powers, exclusive legislation, enumerated powers, and commerce. Okay, so we're pretty close to being done. We might actually be done today. I don't think that there's really some long discourses that were necessary for me to read, but what we want to do is we want to, one, thank you for tuning in. As you know, this is the only show that gives you the academic evidence and the academic-based solutions of what it's going to take to get the get the federal government back into the constitutional framework and also get the states and all levels of government in compliance with the Constitution. See, what happens when you all of a sudden say, hey, that's unconstitutional, and people can start going, wow, if that's unconstitutional, then like the Department of Transportation, then this, and this must be unconstitutional as well. Wow. And so as they go and prove this, as you go and prove this, then it makes it, you know, kind of like the next step, or it creates this automatic deduction to, hey, if these things are unconstitutional, then what else could be unconstitutional as well? The things that we're not aware of, especially when you start understanding just how tightly the framers placed the federal government into these constraints. As we have pointed out, we'll get to it in the Virginia ratification debates, that you cannot even, or the federal government cannot even create a treaty if they do not have the authority to do so. In other words, they don't have the enumerated powers. Like an environmental treaty. You know, all of these environmental treaties that the federal, like the Paris Accord, and these things that they're going to try to strap us with, those are all unconstitutional. They have no authority over this. Folks, what's it going to take to get you to wake up? There are all sorts of people. As you may understand, the Biden administration is giving the Convention of States tailwind, getting them moving, because the argument that has come from the John Birch Society is a flawed argument. It's flawed in so many ways. And first of all, they don't even acknowledge the importance of interposition and what Madison and Jefferson did. They're out there telling people that nullification is the only way to do this. We have to nullify. Well, Madison says otherwise. Madison says if there's a problem with the Constitution, then yes, you nullify. Like the returning of the slaves back to their states of origin or their masters or what have you, if they come to your state. Well, that was a repugnant law. It was repugnant to the fundamentals of the Declaration of Independence, as well as just humanity, the fundamentals of humanity. And so what Wisconsin and other states should have done was they actually should have, either pushed for a convention of states, because that's what you do. When there's a problem with the Constitution, you call for a convention. And so we're going to put this into context. And what we're going to try to do is we're going to have, you know, hopefully a few liberty summits this coming summer, so that we can actually start impressing upon people that Republic Review is the only action that will really solve our problem. Nullification, in so many ways, it won't do anything, especially on the whim, on the concept that the John Birch Society is purporting that, you know, if you nullify it within your state, then that's good enough. And it's not. I want to be clear here. When you look at nullification, it does not interpose with the federal government and force them into compliance. What does it do? Well, it basically says we're not going to enforce that law here in our state. which means that the Common Core is going to still be churning away in these dark blue states, and the Bolshevik Revolution will continue to move forward, and they will continue to tax you at breakneck speeds because the federal government does have the authority to direct tax. And until you initiate Republic Review and identify how these are direct violations and that they must, that they, so... One of the things we've also taught you is that the First Amendment petition for the redress of grievances basically gives you a protection from taxation if these states initiating Republic Review come out and say, look, you are violating the Constitution. You have no powers to do these things. And we demand that you, you know, you do what we tell you to do. And if you don't have, at that point in time, if you do not have enough states to politically force the federal government into compliance, then what do? You withhold taxes, because this goes all the way back to the history, all the way back to Benjamin Franklin. I believe it was his idea that, and maybe even further back, that if we are being subjected to unconstitutional government, to tyranny, to abuses of powers with arbitrary powers assumed, then we do not have to fund government anymore. This is the next step. And this is why Bob Schultz and the We the People Foundation are working with us, because they recognize, man, if we start getting some states on board with this, all the money that the states are sending in for federal taxes, once you have a collective of a few states, and hopefully we'll get 13, and once we have 13, we end the convention of states idea or run. There can't be an amendment if you've got 13 states that say we won't even consider any amendments. We demand compliance first. You get it? So I'm sorry. I want to get into the ratification debate. So the show is also sponsored by republicreview.org, and our comment line is 425-270-5416. You know, I have some people consider it a personality flaw. And I realized a long, long time ago when I was a kid how I really enjoyed being right. And when I was in an argument with my father a long time ago, I think I was like 6 years old, when I had this argument with my father, it kind of came down to, you know, this math argument. And so I proved him wrong, or I proved my point on this math formula. Again, I was six. I think, yeah, I might have been eight. Doesn't matter. At that young age, when you win an argument with your father, boy, that just, man, it really makes you feel good. Like, wow, I was right. Now, I never at any point, never had any inkling or any feelings, like most kids, that my parents didn't know anything. I knew my father was well-educated. He was very literate. And I was always afraid to go down some of these paths in arguing with him, like philosophy and so forth, that I just never cared to learn. And so it was never, I didn't have that rebellious childhood in that they didn't know anything, that I believed I was smarter. I knew I was making different choices, and I felt that the risks were, you know, mitigated to the point where I didn't feel like I was facing any risks. So anyway, back to my flaw, my personality flaw. I'm telling you that I really have a need to be right. So when I got to a point of resolve with Republic Review, after having all these different challenges, nobody, no constitutional professor, nobody can prove, you know, or even refute Republic Review. They don't like it. They can't say that, you know, this can't happen. As a matter of fact, they will try everything to obfuscate the conversation once they are in that position in the corner. And if you remember, I played Dr. Vile, who's, I consider him a conservative guy, and he supports the Convention of States. But he doesn't support Republic Review because he knows what it would do to the money in the education pipeline. It would go away. And so he felt that that would be a bad thing, because some of the things that the federal government is doing is good. Well, First off, I don't believe the federal government should be doing anything what it shouldn't do, and I don't think it should be doing anything in the domestic milieu or the domestic environment. And so what we need to do is we need to get the federal government in full compliance, and then the states need to start having that adult conversation of how they want to manage collectively domestic affairs. I highly recommend that they go down the path of managing their own energy and defining what their strategy is. This is the same thing with the food commodities and so forth. The federal government should never, because they've even proven not worthy of managing the food commodities. You know, the silage that they've had of corn, rice, because when Bush was in office, if you didn't know, in 2006, when inflation started occurring, the way he masked inflation under his presidency, because the quantitative easing and so forth, in helping the, this all kind of set the stage for the bubble, because everything was going up, 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 except for the cost of foods and some other things. So people weren't, you know, wow, this is bad. Well, we're seeing this now, because there is no commodities in the silage anymore. And they don't have enough to start, you know, offsetting. So the whole Arab Spring, just so you understand, the whole Arab Spring, this turmoil that went throughout the Middle East and all these uprisings of the Islam Brotherhood, it was all about there was no food, or they couldn't afford the cost of food. Some, they actually, you know, a family of 10 had to decide which half of the family couldn't eat because they couldn't afford the price anymore. And so I want you to be very clear. I want to be very clear. The states need to have these kind of conversations of how they want to manage and taking care of their, you know, their citizens and or even helping other states if they have a natural disaster. The federal government should never have its fingers in that pie. They've proven. I will be right back after this. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so sorry about the delay. We were just doing something, but what I want to do, and I want to prove this, why we want the states to do this, because one, the states are far more accountable. Everybody should be able to get down to their capital and raise heck, if you know what I mean, if their government is doing bad things. I mean, we have to have an ability to interface with our government. The federal government should only be, if we initiate republic review, legislators will actually be able to go back to part-time legislation. They won't need all the money that they're getting. We can actually cut back their salaries, especially if we actually displace them by passing the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, because the second 10 are actually the last 10 of the 12 amendments is what constituted the Bill of Rights. The first and second were not technically ratified. The second one was ratified. I think it was 1992, something like that. But anyway, to prove my point, how we can't trust the federal government and how they've used the silage and how they've used the gas reserves for these purposes of manipulation, not for actually helping us, we the people, out. So Bush used it to help suppress the inflation that we would have been seeing in the supermarkets. And it's the same thing with the price of gas. As a matter of fact, I think Trump used it to help offset the rising costs of gas. And then he rebuilt that. But those reserves literally need to be done at the state level and managed by the state so that the federal government cannot basically play us against our foreign enemies. This is why, if you look at what Biden is doing, he is deliberately creating policies that give China a direct advantage. But back to the trust. They raided the Social Security Fund how many times? And that's something that they should never have done. Even though it's unconstitutional, and we can have a much better system if we get the federal government out of Social Security. And as a matter of fact, we can do away with social retirement. They have control of your 401ks. They have control of, the stock market. They got control of most of the monetary system when they're not supposed to. Anyway, so Mr. Iredell starts talking about abuses, and he says, and I think I read the first part of this, but I didn't read all of it. The general ground of the objection seemed to be that the power proposed to the general government may be abused. If we give no power, but such as may not be abused, we shall give none, for all delegated powers may be abused. There are two extremes equally dangerous to liberty. These are tyranny, which is what we're dealing with, and anarchy, which is what we're dealing with in the streets with BLM and so forth. We're literally living in a government that is allowing both to exist. And I want to repeat what he just said. There are two extremes equally dangerous to liberty. These are tyranny and anarchy. The medium between these two is the true government to protect the people. In my opinion, this Constitution is well calculated to guard against both of these extremes. They're supposed to take an oath to support and defend the Constitution against the enemies, foreign and domestic. I mean, they're obligated to support the Constitution, which means that they're obligated to protect our liberties. And they're not. They're not doing it on the southern border. They're not doing it in the streets. State officials also take that same oath, and they're obligated. Anyway, we'll rant more about this when I'm not trying to read these things, so forgive me. The possibility of general abuse ought not to be urged, but particular ones pointed out. A gentleman who spoke some time ago, Mr. Lenore, observed that the government might make it treason to write against the most arbitrary proceedings. He corrected himself afterwards by saying he meant misprison of treason. But in the correction he committed as a great mistake as he did at first. Where is the power given them to do this? They have no power to define and punish piracies and felonies committed. Okay, I'm sorry. They have power. So this goes back to what Jefferson said. This is their paradigm. I want you to understand and think about the FBI, the ATF, and every law enforcement agency out there, the plethora of standing armies that the federal government has created. Okay? Listen to what he says.
They have power to define, punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against laws of nations. They have no power to define any other crime whatever. Actually, Jefferson pointed out that treason was one and counterfeiting. Those were the other two. So they have four. And the two that Mr. Iredell just mentioned, these two are committed outside of the boundaries of land in the United States, because crimes committed against laws of nations means that you're in a foreign land where you're committing that crime. And if you're committing crimes out on the high seas, you know, piracy and misdemeanors and so forth, that's outside of the land of the United States as well. And the reason that they basically have this power to, you know, punish these crimes and so forth and define them, why? Is because Britain and other nations were being far more cruel and punishing, killing people as well as, you know, treating them inhumanely, in excess. And so the Constitution basically gave the federal government the ability to protect the U.S. citizens from those types of punishments and the degrees of punishments just because you're American. So they did this to give the United States jurisdiction over all U.S. citizens. Now, we never, because you got to understand that the foreign countries do not have to give us our citizens back for jurisdiction purposes. However, and they didn't in the very beginning of this nation. And it took a while until America became a superpower where we actually had extradition powers in pulling back our citizens to say, okay, you know, we have jurisdiction over this. It's in our laws and you don't have jurisdiction. So anyway, what I also want to do is I want to finish this. So he said, and I'm going to repeat, they have no power to define any other crime whatsoever, such as guns, or whether you can have alcohol, ATF, Bureau of Land Management. Think about all the different crimes and what they're pursuing. You can't go fishing here. You can't go hiking here. They have no ability to define these crimes. It's the same thing with drugs. Every state should have defined all of these crimes. And if you want to have an interstate bureau, the states then have to create that. Do not give this to the federal government. This is why they were talking about these things. And this is why Mr. Iredell was saying they don't even have this power. But somehow they're exercising it. That is the problem. And that's why Republic Review is so important. He goes on and finishes it by saying, this will show how apt gentlemen are to commit mistakes. I am convinced on the part of the worthy member, it was not designed, but arose merely from inattention. In other words, you were not paying attention, buddy. Mr. Lenore comes back and said that those punishments might be inflicted by them within the 10-mile squares where they would have exclusive powers of legislation. Now, Mr. Iredell responds by saying they are to have exclusive power of legislation, but how? Wherever they may have this district, they may possess it from the authority of the state within which it lies, and that state may stipulate the conditions of the secession. Will not such state take care of the liberties of its own people? What would be consequence if the seat of government of the United States, with all the archives of America, was in the power of any one particular state? Would not this be most unsafe and humiliating? Do we not all remember that in the year 1783, this is under the Articles of Confederation, a band of soldiers went and insulted Congress? The sovereignty of the United States was threatened with indignity. They applied for protection to the state they resided in, but could not obtain none. It is to be hoped such a disgraceful scene will never happen again, but that for the future, the national government will be able to protect itself. The powers of the government are particularly enumerated and defined. They can claim no others but those that are enumerated. In my opinion, they are excluded as much from exercising any other authority as they could be by the most strongest negative clause that could be framed. A gentleman has asked, What would be the consequence if they had the power of the purse and the sword? I ask, in what government, both under heaven, in what government under heaven are these not given up to the authority of others? There is a necessity of giving both the purse and sword to every government, or else it cannot protect the people. Okay, so I hope you understand here. I mean, Mr. Iredell, the North Carolina debates are really, really good in clarifying the Constitution. The Virginia ratification debates are the best. I mean, it's the cream of the crop. They argue everything down to martial law, everything. So, commerce, right? And so this is a comment from Mr. Bloodworth, again, who is an anti-federalist, and he observed that the first convention, which met to consult on the necessary alterations of the Confederation so as to make it efficient and put the commerce of the United States on a better footing, not consisting, and I have a bad habit of bleeding into, so I'm going to stop myself right there. We'll pick it up at the top again, since we just started, and we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL. Or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Isn't it nice that we have a 24-hour comment line? Isn't that nice? Anyway, sorry. Let me repeat. So Mr. Bloodworth gets up and he basically starts talking about the commission or the, you know, the Constitutional Convention. And so, and it doesn't start off with this quote. Basically, it says he stood up and observed that the first, and this is what he says, that the first convention, which met to consult on the necessary alterations of the Confederation so as to make it efficient and put the commerce of the United States on a better footing, not consisting of a sufficient number from the different states so as to authorize them to proceed, returned without affecting anything, but proposed that another convention should be called to have more extensive powers to alter and amend the Confederation. So just so you understand, that was the Annapolis Convention that he's talking about. This proposition of that convention was warmly opposed in Congress. Mr. King from Massachusetts insisted on the impropriety of the measure and the existing system ought to stand as it was. His arguments, he said, were that it might destroy the Confederation to propose alterations and that the unanimous consent of all the states was necessary to introduce those alterations, which could not be possible or could not possibly be obtained, and that it would therefore be in vain to attempt it. He wondered how gentlemen came to entertain different opinions. He declared he had listened with the attention to the arguments of the gentleman on the other side and had endeavored to remove every kind of bias from his mind. Yet he had heard nothing of sufficient weight to induce him to alter his opinion. He was sorry that there was any division on that import of occasion. But again, so he's just trying to go back and point out that the whole point was that they were supposed to recommend in the convention. But Mr. Bloodworth is obviating, or he's completely masking the reality that the states were the problem, just like the states are the problem today. The states have been lulled into this trance, this spell done by the federal government, the the subordinate government in America, because it's supposed to be supporting the states, and the states are the sovereigns. The federal government is only sovereign over those enumerated powers. And so going, you know, into this whole concept of the convention again, that they exceeded their power, or this is all they were supposed to do, and they actually did something different, and how he wanted to cite Mr. King from Massachusetts, who says this was wrong. Everybody, when they voted on this in the states, and even the state legislatures, realized that this was a legitimate convention. What they did was they proposed by having conventions of the people, which is what they did. That's why it said the conventions of nine states to debate this. In other words, not letting the state legislatures, who are at the trough of power at that point in time, to say, do we want to have an effectual union, or do we want to go back to being independent sovereign states? Because this concept of a unified union was a failure, and they were actually dealing with all rogue. You know, I've covered this ad nauseum. So, as you know, and as you understand, what we're dealing with today is, and I'll just say, this is a godsend. This is the divine hand of providence, who gave us not just everything we needed for government to exist, but he gave us everything we needed within this Constitution by obtaining the 14th Amendment, that we the people could always cast off our government without ever having to go through a revolution. We don't have to pull triggers here, my friends. All we have to do is utilize the Constitution as our weapon as well as our defense. Now, towards the very end, they actually had a bunch of declarations, and I could read through those, and then they had amendments to the Constitution, which I could also read. And in the amendments of the Constitution, they had some amendments to the exclusive powers and so forth. But for the most part, I just don't believe that it is probably the best of our time in going through these amendments. I did this with the other states so you could kind of see how there were some parallels. And as they went back in August 2nd, so this was in July 1787, they came back to meet again while Congress was in session in August of 88. In 1788. So what they did was they actually met real quick and they said, absolutely, we want to be a part of this, and they ratified. And so they don't go into a lot of details as to why it kind of fell out of not ratifying. Don't know, but they chose not to. I think that there were some fears by some people that they just didn't think that they had the numbers, that North Carolina might actually not be a part of the union, and they're better off, you know, watching this new, because they knew the government was going to stand. And as a matter of fact, by, you know, shortly after they convened to say we're not going to do this, they found out New York had already ratified. So now it wasn't just 10 states, it was 11. And so just trying to help you understand that North Carolina had some really good debates, but I don't think that they had the faith in just trying to do the ratification or to ascend to the Constitution in 1787. So they just waited a year to kind of watch the federal government and how well it stayed on the tracks. And as they saw that, they go, wow, this is actually working. It's functioning. And this isn't as bad as we thought. Anywho, that wraps up North Carolina. How's that sound, huh? Pretty good. Well, now what we've got is the Virginia ratification debates. They started June 2nd. This is when they convened. And when we get into some of the jurisdiction, wow, okay, so I have this on really small font, and I'm just going to, there we go, you know, blow it up a little bit. Anyway, so what we want to do is we just want to cover these highlights because we have a lot. And this is Mr. Nicholas, and this is regarding jurisdiction. This is basically 2 days later. They were already convening and so forth. And actually, what I may do is I'll probably do it tomorrow. We may go back and read through regarding the convention having, you know, trying to actually stop the convention altogether, because that's what Henry was trying to do. And so what he wanted to do was basically say, hey, the commission exceeded their powers. We shouldn't even be having this convention. And we should basically call for, you know, the Articles of Confederation to remain intact so that we can, you know, have a proper convention and actually amend the Articles of Confederation instead. I mean, that's how pernicious Mr. Henry was. Now, I know a lot of people just look up to him as a really good man. He was a good, staunch fighter for liberty, but he was also a good, staunch fighter for the sovereignty of the states and the states to maintain its power, that they couldn't move to the next level of a hybrid constitutional republic. He just couldn't fathom this. And so this is why what the Constitution, what became what we know as the Constitution, how it really broke the mold of government and how government was to support the republic vice versa. Because every other time they've created a general government, such as the Roman Empire and all of the other republics like Germany. Look at what Germany was, a republic when Hitler came to power. And so what he had to do, and if you ever read Mein Kampf, Hitler actually tells the Republic that he needs to have a little bit more power, that they need to basically disband the Republic so that he can collect all the power necessary so that he could move Germany in the direction Germany needed to go. Okay, so I am here to tell you that their Republic was still nothing like ours because they did have general powers within their Constitution. Even Britain. Every nation, every sovereign state in the world, or every republic that had a general government, they had general powers. This is the only government that ever created a republic, but also made it in a confederation form. As we've talked about at the very beginning of this process, that you have a federation and a confederation. A confederation is a body of states that possess most all of the power, and they delegate limited power to a general government. Now, those general powers usually are very, you know, not war, those types of things. So in creating this federation, we gave the general government the ability to tax and fight wars for us, the purse and the sword. And that's what everybody was pointing out. But that was it. That was really it. And so when you kind of look at, you know, what we have, it's really a hybrid between a federation and a confederation. That's why when if you ever see me write, I usually try to remember to keep in context that we have a hybrid constitutional republic. So the people understand that there is both a federation and a confederation operating within this republic. Anyway, this is Mr. Nicholas. We're in Virginia now. And this is what he says. It is objected, however, as a defect in the Constitution that it does not prohibit the House of Representatives from giving their powers, particularly that respecting the support, etc., of armies. And so I'm going to have to repeat this. So I'll just start off at the top when we come back. But folks, we're there. We're in the last debates. This is the meat. So if you've got some steak sauce, you may want to keep it handy. We'll be right back after these two promos. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so starting off at the top, Mr. Nicholas objected, however, if as a defect in the Constitution, it does not prohibit the House of Representatives from giving their power, particularly that respecting the support, etc., of armies out of their hands for longer than a term of 2 years. Here, I think the enemies to the plan, and I love that. I mean, he's calling them out, right? These are your enemies to this plan. Okay, so I think the enemies to the plan reason unfairly. They first suppose that Congress, from a love of power natural to all, will, in general, abuse it with which they are invested, and then they would make us apprehend that the House of Representatives, notwithstanding their love for power, and it must be supposed as great in a breach or a branch of Congress as in the whole, will give out their hands to only check which can ensure to them the continuance of the participation of the powers lodged in Congress in general. In England, there is no restraint of this kind in Parliament, and yet there is no instance of a money bill being passed for a longer term than 1 year. The proposed plan, therefore, when it declares that no appropriation for the support of army shall be made for longer than a term of 2 years, introduces a check unknown to the English Constitution, and one which will be found very powerful when we reflect that if the House of Representatives could be prevailed on to make an appropriation for an army for 2 years, at the end of that time, there will be a new choice of representatives. Thus, I insist that this, because you got to remember that when at the end of the year before the elections, that's, you know, they're not in session at the time. the representatives go home so that you can vote for them again. And then, because that's when the money ends. And then when they go back, they have a new budget and they, you know, they can continue or not. But the point is that if the people didn't like the fact that there was an army for 2 years and they were being misused, abused, or what have you, how many people would continue to vote in that same person? Well, back in those days, the perspective was that, because they understood the Constitution far better, the understanding was that they would actually vote for somebody else. Anyway, thus I insist that security does not depend on the number of representatives. The experience of that country also shows that many of their counties and cities contain a greater number of souls than will be entitled to a representation in America. And yet the representatives chosen in those places have been the most strenuous advocates of liberty and have exerted themselves in the defense of it, even in opposition to those chosen by much smaller numbers. Many of the senatorial districts in Virginia also contained a greater number of souls, and yet I suppose no gentleman within these walls will pay the senators chosen by them so poor a compliment as to attribute less wisdom and virtue to them than the delegates chosen from the single counties, and that there is a greater probability that the electors in the large districts will be more independent. So I think the representatives chosen in such districts will be more so too, for those who have sold themselves to their representatives will have no right to complain if they, in their turn, barter away their rights and liberties. But those who have not themselves been bought will never consent to be sold. Another objection made to the small number of representatives is that admitting they were sufficient to secure the integrity, yet they cannot be acquainted with the local situation and circumstances of their constituents. When we attend to the object of their jurisdiction, we find this objection insupportable. Congress will superintend the great national interest of the Union. Local concerns are left to the state legislators. When the members compare and communicate to one another their knowledge of their representative districts and states, their collective intelligence will sufficiently enable them to perform the objects of their cognizance. They cannot extend their influence or agency to any objects but those of a general nature. The representatives will therefore be sufficiently acquainted with the interests of their states. Although chosen by large districts, as the people remain virtuous and uncorrupted, so long we may fairly conclude with, will their representatives, even at the present number, guard their interest and discharge their duty with fidelity and zeal? When they become otherwise, no government can possibly secure their freedom. Now, so one of the things that really jumps out here is, if you didn't notice, these districts were made up of counties, not partial counties, counties. And so this is how they basically looked at government in itself. They didn't break down districts, you know, by just counting the total number of people and then kind of divided it. What they did was they basically portioned it. So you understand that the Constitution basically claimed at this point in time that 30,000 people would have a representative. Well, what they did was they broke down the counties. And so some counties may have had a little bit larger number and other counties had smaller. And so they still went by the county anyway. And that's the same thing with the senators. And when they created their state government, counties were sovereigns. And this is what we proved in the Missouri Compromise, in the Missouri Enabling Act that caused the Missouri Compromise. When we looked at how Congress had called forth Missouri to become a state, it basically called forth people from each county, a number by representation of the amount of people in each county, to come to the state and create this constitution of the state of Missouri. What that means is that they recognize that the counties were the sub-element of government. and that that's how representation was broken down. They didn't break it down by populations of the people and dissolve the boundaries of the counties. They felt that that was repugnant to those people who had their identity within that county. They've created their businesses, they've created their station in life, and it was, you know, you were a citizen of that county as well as the state. Anyway, as we go on, June 5th, we start getting into some kind of interesting points here. And so this is Mr. Pendleton, and he basically says, but it is represented to be a consolidated government annihilating that of the states. Now, see, again, these same arguments are being brought forth in Virginia as they were in every other state. A consolidated government, which is so extensive a territory as the United States, cannot admit of and without terminating in despotism. If this be such a government, I will confess with my worthy friend that it is inadmissible over such a territory as this country. Let us consider whether it be such a government or not. I should understand a consolidated government to be that which should have the sole and exclusive power, legislative, executive, and judicial, without any limitations. Is this such a government, or can it be changed to one? It only extends to the general purpose of the Union. It does not intermeddle with the local and particular affairs of the states. Can Congress legislate for the state of Virginia? Can they make law altering the form of transferring property or the rule of descents in Virginia? In one word, can they make a single law for the individual exclusive property of any one state? It is the interest of the federal to preserve the state governments upon the latter existence of the former. The Senate derives its existence immediately from the state legislatures, and the representatives and presidents are elected under direction and control. They also preserve order among the citizens with their respective states, and without order and peace, no society can possibly exist. Unless, therefore, there be state legislatures to continue the existence of Congress and preserve order and peace among the inhabitants, this general government, which gentlemen suppose will annihilate the state governments, must be itself be destroyed. When, therefore, the federal government is, in so many respects, so absolutely dependent on the state governments, I wonder how any gentleman reflecting on the subject could conceive any idea of possibility of the former destroying the latter. But the power of laying direct taxes is objected. Government must be supported. This cannot be done without revenue if a sufficient revenue be not otherwise raised. Recurrence must be had to direct taxation. Gentlemen admit this, but insist on the property of first applying to the state legislators. Now, I want to take a quick side here. And as a matter of fact, I got less than a minute. So what I want to actually kind of point out is that as he was talking about these representatives and the states being the base element, that there was no way that they could afford to destroy the states because they were dependent on the states for their station and everything else. Well, over time, the federal government has literally opened up purses and doing things it has no constitutional power to do, that they've been able to marginalize the states' roles and making states more of an administrative or perceived as administrative, even though legitimately every state still possesses the constitutional authority that it was granted, or actually it possessed when they created this constitution. There has been no change in the authority and the roles between the states and the general government. This is why we have to initiate Republic Review to restore our constitutional republic. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic, and we need your help. God bless. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our constitution and our republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.